I'm Kerry Levy, and this is Gonservation Conversations. On the far side of the world in Samoa lives a bird called the manumea, which is now termed as critically endangered on the IUCN Red List. But why has this happened? And what creative initiatives can be put into place to prevent this creature, sometimes termed as the little dodo, from sliding into extinction? Well, to hopefully provide some answers live and direct from Samoa and representing the Save the Manumea campaign and the Samoa Conservation Society are James Atherton, Jane Va'afasuwanga and Moyumu Willie. Hello and welcome to you all. I hope I pronounced all the names correctly. And James, please don't tell me it was yours that I got wrong.
Yours was perfect. No, good job, good job. We like to say Samoa. When we talk about Samoa, we kind of accentuate the first vowel, the first A. That's how it's normally pronounced. It's Samoa, not Samoa. Otherwise, perfect, Kerry, perfect.
Okay, but I've been corrected. I don't mind being corrected because I like things to be right. It's like my name's Kerry, C-E-R-I. It's four letters. How many problems can that cause for people? Well, a lot. People call me Seri, Cherry. How do you pronounce this? All those sort of things are a real problem. So, yeah, okay, Samoa. Is that better?
That's right. Make it last. Make it last.
Samoa.
That's one. Good. Excellent.
Okay.
In fact, Kerry, you've got it right within a few moments when some people who've lived here for much of their life could still not get it right, unfortunately. Expats who come here struggle with that, but well done.
Oh, thank you very much. I feel chuffed. I feel as though we might as well finish there. I'm on a winner now, so let's go. All right, James. Well, look, you're the president of the Samoa. See, It's interesting. You've got to think about it. You're the president of the Samoa Conservation Society. Now, what does that entail? How long have you been doing it? Is it one of these jobs that's really a voluntary position?
Well, it is voluntary. I've been doing it on and off for a few years. We have a team of people. It's not just me, of course. We have an executive of about eight of us, plus all our members, around 40 or 50 people who are actively supporting us off and on, not all at the same time, unfortunately, but we do have a pool of people that's great to use for our projects. We were formed in 2013, and so we're a relatively new NGO with a mission to conserve Samoa's biodiversity, which is a bit of a challenge because we do have major threats to our natural heritage here and our biodiversity. We have over 100 species that are on the IUCN Red List and classified as threatened to some degree, and including our national bird, the manumea, which I'm sure we'll be talking a lot about during this program, the toothbilled pigeon, which is related to the extinct dodo, one of the only relatives of the dodo, so a very important member of our planet's biodiversity that we're concerned a lot about because it's down to probably only 200 species, 200 birds, excuse me. So we do a lot of different projects to do with raising awareness about environmental issues, particularly in the communities, because the school system here doesn't necessarily teach people much about local natural heritage. They tend to learn more about overseas issues. So we focus on our natural heritage, and we teach people about our birds and our forest, what's special about it, and then we look at the threats to those, and then we look at solutions. So we have a program called the Green Livelihoods Program, which is looking holistically at sort of management of natural resources focused on village youth in particular. That's one thing we do. And then we've got this program on manumea, which we'll talk more about shortly, the national bird, and we use that as a flagship to promote broader conservation efforts, because being the national bird is sort of a focus for us, and it's very unique, you know, taxonomically unique, and down to probably only 200 birds, so on the brink of extinction. And if we don't get our act together soon, we're going to lose it. But we are doing quite a bit to make that not happen, including working with communities on setting up conservation areas and forest reserves, through to trying to manage the threat from hunting and raising awareness about hunting, which is one of the bigger threats to our national bird, to managing invasive species like rats in particular. We're piloting a project that Moyumu can talk about in terms of rat management. And then trying to look at, because in Samoa, obviously, you can't just go in there and say, don't do that, without thinking about what are the alternatives. So if you're stopping people from hunting, for example, hunters who might make a living from hunting pigeons, including the toothbill pigeon, then you need to think about what else can they do to compensate or to basically make a living if they're not hunting. So we're promoting ecotourism activities, trails, bird hides. We've done training for ecotourists, training for guides to teach or to rather take ecotourists into the forest. So a range of different things, and we work very closely with a lot of partners because we're actually a very small organization. We only have one full-time staff, Moy, who's a research person based with us, and then two part-time staff, including Jane, who you'll be talking to shortly. But we have quite a small resource base. But we bring in partnerships, including this one with Ralph Steadman, and we're very grateful for the interest of your team in the UK and Ralph and you, Kerry, on supporting us, and thank you very much. It's really awesome for us living in the middle of the South Pacific to have so many partnerships all around the world. People who supporting us and you know, moral support as well as financial support is really incredible and gives us hope. So the partnership building component of what we do is really fundamental, and we work with the Ministry of Environment here very closely and other ministries and other NGOs, and we try our best to link out to as many different relevant groups as possible because we don't have the capacity to implement everything ourselves. And actually, it's much more efficient to work with your partners and use their capacity and build their capacity together. So really, that's the model that we've followed. And bringing in donor money from a mixture of local and overseas donors, bilaterals, you know, New Zealand aid, UK aid, and the big multilaterals, you know, the UNDP, Global Environment Facility, and so on. Quite a few donors out there. But our job really, if you like, is bringing in the partnerships, bringing in some funds, and then working with our partners to get things done. So that's SCS in a nutshell.
That's quite a big nutshell as well. I like it. There's so much to think about in what you've just opened with. There's so many things I'd like to ask. Like, can you set the scene for the richness of the flora and fauna over there and describe the habitat which is home to the Manumea?
Okay, well, the Samoa Islands are around about 5 million years old, which is relatively young geologically, but you know, long enough for a lot of species to evolve. So in that 5 million years, we have had quite a lot of evolution of new species. Around about 30% or about a third of our biodiversity here is endemic, so only found here, including the national bird, the Manumea. And interestingly, the Manumea, which is a type of pigeon, it only was evolved in the western islands of Samoa. It didn't even make it to the eastern islands of American Samoa, which are about 80 kilometers away. So it's quite interesting and unusual this bird evolved here and stayed here. And there were a few other species like that that are basically restricted to one island. You know, typical sort of island biogeography where we kind of fit that classic pattern of species that evolve in small places and then kind of stay there because, you know, they find it great, I suppose. It's good climate. It's warm. We're only 13 degrees from the equator, so there's not a lot of seasonal variation. It's wet and then it's very wet and it's always warm. So it's a fantastic place for any species to have found themselves. And then they've evolved into, you know, new forms. So we have, as I said, around about 30% of species across different taxonomic groups are endemic. We have more ferns than New Zealand, which we're quite proud of, considering that New Zealand is 85 times bigger than Samoa. And we like to tease our New Zealand friends because they're the land of the silver fern, but actually we're the land of a lot more ferns, even though we're tiny. I mean, the land area of Samoa is only 3,000 square kilometers. So it's a small landmass, but because of climate and, you know, we've had 5 million years of evolution, so that's even though on a global scale that's a drop, it is enough time for lots of new species to evolve. And we have fairly rugged topography. We have mountains up to about 2,000 meters or 1,800 meters, 6,000 feet for the old school, which is higher than any mountain in the UK, of course, which is, of course, much, much bigger. So it's a fairly mountainous place, and there's lots of different habitats and niches for species evolution. And yeah, so that's all of those factors result in a fairly rich biodiversity.
Fantastic. Well, the next thing I'd like to ask is, why is this bird the national bird of Samoa? Do we know why? Is it because it was populous or?
I think it was identified way back in the 1800s by some European scientists as being evolutionarily very, very unique, and they recognize it as a relative of the dodo. The scientist, I forget the name, I think it was a guy called Peel, but I'm not sure, back in the 1800s, named it Didunculus, which means little dodo. So from early on, it's this weirdest pigeon that has a toothed bill, which is unlike other pigeons, except the dodo, of course. So they recognized it as being special. And I would never say they were common, but they were certainly around a lot. And plenty of birds were caught and taken to museums around the world. And now in London and Berlin and America, there's stuffed Manumea. So there must have been quite a few around in those days. And so people were aware of it. Locals were aware of it. And the scientists were also aware of its uniqueness. So I think it was a bird that was never as common, say, as the common pigeon or the Pacific pigeon. It was always a bird that was a little bit unusual and secretive and living in the forest and maybe shy of people. And often you'd only see it in the canopy. And I think Samoans have different names for it. Actually, Manumea is only one name. It was another one that other names for it as well. But the bird was a secretive bird, a special bird, a unique bird. And together, it seemed to be a natural choice to become the national bird for all of those factors. Especially, I think, the uniqueness in terms of its taxonomy and the fact that it's related to the dodo. And it is a beautiful bird. I mean, if I was lucky enough years ago to see it once. And even though it was about 20 meters or 30 meters away, and I had my binoculars, but it was in the top of a tree and it was not really super clear. But I could see this big sort of brownish, reddish, chestnutty colored bird with this sort of reddish beak. And it's very unusual looking animal. So, you know, it's a beautiful bird and it's special. And obviously, we want to do our best to save it. And in doing so, and this is sort of important sort of message that we try to sort of spread here in Samoa, that if we save the Manumea, we actually save the whole forest environment as well, because you can't just save the Manumea alone without saving the forest. And with that, you save everything. So it is a flagship. So although it's important to focus on the flagships and the sexy animals and the beautiful animals and the animals that are unique in some way as what we call flagships, but, you know, we have to use that as a way to sort of promote broader conservation. And that's certainly what we do here in Samoa.
I always talk about the telescopic view, that you focus in on this one tiny creature, and then it's like you pull focus back and back and back, and suddenly the whole bigger picture is revealed. So I totally understand what you're saying there. One of the things that always concerns me is the causes of the demise of a creature. Now, would it be fair to say that the biggest factor is hunting? I'm sure logging as well as that and several other reasons, habitat loss will count. But how big is hunting as an issue?
I think it is one of the major factors. I'd be hesitant to say it is the one. I think invasive species and rats and cats would be up there pretty close. But hunting is one that perhaps we have most control over because it's human caused. And so that's been a focus of our effort the last 2 years when we launched our first Manumea campaign back in 2019. And we painted murals, and Jane can speak to this, of the Manumea around the place to get it in people's consciousness. So the focus at that time was really on the hunting issue, because we know a lot of people are hunting pigeons, and they're particularly hunting the what we call the Pacific pigeon or the lupe, which is a very tasty bird. And they're going for that one, and often they will kill the Manumea by mistake. So it's often not the target of the hunting. Apparently, some say it doesn't taste as good as the Pacific pigeon. But when they see a bird in the trees, they just shoot it, and often it's the Manumea. So by raising awareness about the threat of hunting to the Manumea and to the lupe, that's a big part of what we try to do. And we have a law which is basically, you know, that hunting endemic birds is illegal. There's very little awareness of that, number one. Number two, even if there is awareness, there's no enforcement. What we want to do is for people to sort of self-regulate and actually want to go by and abide by the law, because without managing the threat of hunting, especially to the Manumea, it could well go extinct. So that, if you like, is in our basket of things that we have some influence over. Although on the face of it, it may seem, well, that should be fairly straightforward. Well, it isn't, because actually eating pigeon is part of a traditional diet. And our giving pigeon to chiefs and to respected members of the community is a way to show respect to them. So there is a commercial trade in it for that kind of purpose. You give the hunter money. He goes and kills the birds for you. You then give that to your preacher or the chief or somebody you want to show respect to. That's part of the culture. And so it's not easy to change that. In fact, we're not saying that we need to change that. What we're saying is we need to manage it. We need to think about the overall impact. When you think about when people first were hunting these birds, they didn't have guns. They just had slingshots or nets. They often catch these birds with nets made of spiny plants. And that was a traditional practice of the chiefs. So my point is that the impact was low because the techniques used were simple, right? But now we have all these shotguns, and you can just blast the birds out of the sky. So the level of impact is way higher, and therefore we need to manage it. So our story or our message is, we respect Samoan culture, and we respect the fact that this is a traditional food, but we need to manage this. First of all, we shouldn't really have a commercial sale in pigeons. No one should be making money from this. Secondly, there is a law, of course, that says this is illegal. But more importantly than the law is why. So the reason is, if we do not reduce our threat and manage the hunting, bring it right down, then this bird could well go extinct. And it'll be on our watch, and we'll be responsible for it. And we future generations will not be very impressed with us. So we have to do our bit to save our bird and our other forest species. And it just means being aware of our impacts and managing them more carefully than we've done in the past. Yeah,
I get that. And this is a problem that is not easy to explain to people, especially from other countries and what have you. I've done a lot of campaigning against the illegal hunting of migratory species in Malta. And the thing that always gets leveled at you is, you're from outside, you're interfering, this is tradition. It's kind of different there because it's a sport, really. Yes, they eat pigeon as well.
Yeah.
And they say, we've always done this. I think you're absolutely correct in trying to work out how do you approach the subject, because you can't just say you can't do this. It's how do you end up offering the alternatives? How do you share the information of how we can evolve this together? Because part of it, you mentioned the word responsibility, part of it has to be everyone accepting a responsibility and understanding it's necessary for all the reasons we talked about the whole environment.
Well, absolutely. I think we think about COVID, and we think about how we manage COVID through collective responsibility. It's the same principle with managing the environment. We have a global issue with wildlife loss, just as we have a global pandemic, and we have a global crisis with climate change. They all require global thinking or broader thinking than just me to solve it. So we're trying to promote that communal thinking, thinking beyond our own needs, thinking about the future, because it's the only way we can solve all these crises. It's the same principle, I believe, to solve all the major global crises that we face and move beyond an individual greed. While we respect tradition, absolutely, and culture, absolutely. At the same time, things have changed, as you said, that people cannot keep using the argument, well, it's tradition, in a context that's totally different and in a reality that's totally different. And so it's about modifying behavior accordingly. So we debated this a lot about whether we should be pushing a ban, a total ban, because it's illegal, therefore we should just ban it. And we should tell everybody it's illegal, don't do it. And then we thought, well, first of all, the ban never worked. So why all of a sudden is it going to work with our program? And we don't really have, 5,000 policemen in our organization, and we don't have any. So how do you get out there and enforce it? And secondly, are people really going to be happy about that? Well, they're not. They're going to be pissed off. So, you've got to be sensible about what is realistic and what people will buy into. So what we think people will buy into and we believe is working is the idea of managing it, reducing the hunting pressure, stopping the commercial sale, and over time, and it's going to take a while, plugging away at the environmental awareness, the consciousness, and basically presenting facts, so that people understand. Because at the end of the day, every person on the planet makes decisions that will either be good or bad for the planet. But it's getting into people's thinking and awareness about why is my behavior important, and how, if I change it, will it make things better or worse? So and we want everybody to think that way, but it does take time. It takes a lot of messaging. It takes a lot of things that people will buy into and find attractive. I mean, we put these Manumea signs all around the place. Beautiful, great big murals, and people love them. And that's, you've got to build pride, you've got to build positive messages, and not sort of talk about bans or you can't do this, you can't do that. So it's about how we present our work in a way that people will say, yeah, I like that, I get it, I won't eat pigeon this year. Yeah, I get it. And that's what we want.
And it's also about offering the alternatives to people. And
yeah.
And I guess we can talk about this. I'm going to move to Jane in a second to talk about community, communal thinking, the Save the Mani Meier campaign. But yeah, I think, what are you offering as alternatives? Are you suggesting that ecotourism has a part to play, as well as hunting bans, of course, or restricted hunting? And I'm sure there's predator control and also reinvigorating the habitat. But is ecotourism a potential big part in this?
I'll just briefly give you my thoughts, and I'm going to hand over to Jane because she actually runs an eco-tour business, so she's extremely well-placed to respond to that question. But just the broader issues, definitely promoting ecotourism. This year, obviously, not good for that, but eventually we will move beyond COVID and tourists will come back, and that is an alternative. So we have worked with villages on trails and bird hides. But beyond that, we're pushing a green livelihood concept, you know, things like organic farming, sustainable forestry, or, raising awareness about the need to have marine reserves and the value of marine reserves to boost your fish in the lagoon. So we take a holistic view when we work with the villagers on a whole range of other livelihoods, if you like, that can be good for the environment, that could potentially replace the money or the food from hunting or the hunting pigeon or doing bad things. But there's a whole new thinking in Samoa and the Pacific now about green living, and there's a huge number of people who are into organic farming and all these health drinks and you know, turmeric drinks and sort of organic handicrafts, and you know, it's booming, and beekeeping and honey and I could go on, and biogas and village biofuel production from bioenergy. So there's a whole lot of new initiatives that we call sort of green livelihoods that can replace the damaging work. Another example is lots of projects in Samoa are now planting trees. We have a 2 million trees program. We've managed to get quite a bit of funding from donors to pay people to plant trees. So it actually, people get money to do the right thing. They get paid for it. So that's a real win-win. You know, there's a lot of poverty in the village, especially this year. And we have whole teams of people, and this is another project that SCS is doing, teams of people to plant trees. They get paid, they get an income. So that's good for the environment. We absorb carbon. We do a carbon offset program where we actually sort of work out the footprint of various businesses. And then we plant trees to offset that. And at the same time, people get paid. And they get an income, and we build their green thinking. So you know, there are alternatives, and that's a very good question. But I think Jane can talk a lot more about her experience working in ecotourism, especially in her village. So I'll let you hand over.
Okay, Jane. Well, I think this is a very good moment to bring you in and to take part in the conversation. Yeah, I'd love to know your views on ecotourism.
Sure. James has painted a great picture of what we're doing with the Samoa Conservation Society, with the Ministry of Natural Resources and Environment working together, and just been great to listen because he's just put it all into perspective. So thank you for that, James. If I can talk a little bit more about the campaign and as you've asked, Kerry, about ecotourism. So I'm actually a New Zealander. I'm from Wellington. My husband is Samoan, hence the surname Vafusuanga. And my husband's from the village of Faliase'ela, which is about an hour out of town. We're on the southwest coast. So I've spent a lot of time there. I've lived in the village for over 12 years. And so I've been able to see firsthand what's happening in the village. And we do have a small ecotourism business there that obviously with COVID, nothing much is happening at the moment. But generally when there are tourists, our business, and we involve a lot of people from the village who work for us. And our business is we do hiking, we do tours. Well, when I say we, my husband usually leads the tours to the waterfalls. We have beautiful waterfalls. We have a rainforest. And my husband, his name's Tuia Fatea. That's his chiefly title. It's been great to have people from overseas visiting and to take people to these untouched places. There's if you start a hike from our backyard, there's 14 waterfalls that you can visit in 5 hours. So it's actually amazing, and it's a beautiful rainforest. And so we have young guys and young girls that work for us as tour guides. And then Tui's been very strong in saying that, you know, if you're going to work in ecotourism, you also have to be involved in conservation, that you can't have one without the other. So as James was saying, with COVID and no visitors, these guys have been involved in conservation programs, and they've been involved in pest control, particularly for the manomea and other native birds in the rainforest. They've been involved in habitat restoration, and you know, we can get funding as an NGO and working with the Ministry of Environment programs where we do habitat restoration specifically for the manomea and other birds, but obviously it benefits the whole forest. And these young people, and not so young as well, anybody's welcome, who are usually involved in tourism, have been able to work in conservation and do tree planting, habitat restoration, as I said, pest control, and they can get some pocket money for that, which is great. I mean, they do it anyway alongside the ecotourism, but they've been able to focus on that particularly in the last year.
So, okay, I want to take you to the actual Save the Manumea campaign, because I'd like to know how it came into being and how it was launched and who launched it, because it's quite a thing to set up a campaign and to get something up and running and to make it have a visible effect on people.
Yes, that's right. Samoa Conservation Society works very intimately and alongside the Ministry of Natural Resources and Environment. So we have a lot of support there. And so we work together on this campaign. We also have a lot of partners. We obviously need funding to do this kind of thing. And so when we did the actual campaign, we worked a lot with Flinch Marketing, a marketing company in New Zealand, and their staff came over here. We had funding from the New Zealand High Commission. We had other people in New Zealand that supported us in the campaign, the Department of Conservation, just to get things up and running. And when we launched our campaign, we actually launched it in July 2019. It was initially a one-year campaign. The manomea is a very shy and a very rare bird. And as James mentioned, there's less than 200 left. And most Samoans actually haven't seen it in their lifetime. If you've seen it, you're very lucky. So the first thing we wanted to do in the campaign was to let people know what the manomea looked like. So one of the first activities we did in the campaign, once we had some funding from our partners, is that we organised for Charles and Janine Williams, who are Māori artists from New Zealand, to come to Samoa. And the reason we asked them to come is, one, they specialise in large-scale murals of native birds. So they came over and we searched around Samoa for walls around our pier to paint this huge mural on. And in Samoa, a lot of the buildings don't have many walls. We have a lot of windows and a lot of open spaces, but we managed to find a wall on the New Zealand High Commission and painted this amazing mural, and there are images of it online if anybody wants to see it. So they painted this amazing mural in like 5 days, and it just happened that the Prime Minister of New Zealand was flying into Samoa for less than 24 hours. She was on her way to Tokelau, which you can, a small island you can only get to by boat from Samoa, and it takes 24 hours to get there by boat. So very remote, but she was here for 24 hours. And while she was here, she very kindly worked with the New Zealand High Commission. So the Prime Minister of New Zealand, Jacinda Ardern, and our Deputy Prime Minister, Fiamei Naomi Mataafa, was available, and together they launched the mural. So it was a real a launch with a bang. We had this amazing huge mural, and we had a Prime Minister from New Zealand and our Deputy Prime Minister, who was also at that time the Minister of Environment. And we were able to launch our campaign with this amazing mural, which is right down on our main road, Beach Road. And it's just an amazing reminder of our national bird, which people before that usually only saw on the currency. It's on our 20 tala note and our 50 cent coin. But now the feedback we're getting from everybody is, oh, wow, this is what the manomea looks like. Now I know what it looks like. So that was our very start.
So, you've been doing this work to engage with the local communities. How have the local communities on the whole taken to what you're doing? And I presume there are certain villages that are more helpful or more integrated with your ideas than others. How's it been working?
Yes, that's right. So once we launched our awareness campaign, we had also a project that we were doing, and our funding came from SMSMCL, which is Strengthening Multisectoral Management of Critical Landscapes. And we actually got funding. It was through a project with the MNRE. And so once we launched our campaign, we had funding to start work. And what we did, we worked with together Samoa Conservation Society and MNRE, and we identified identified 5 or 6 key villages, because as James was talking before, it's very hard to police the shooting of birds and things like that. So what we did was 5 key villages where the manomea had been seen most recently. So there are 3 on the island of Upoluan and 2 or 3 on the island of Savai. And we focused our work and our funding that we had to work with those communities in those villages. So we worked with the MNRE and we had village consultations. A lot of those communities are already doing conservation, so they were aware of the manomea. And we went into the villages, we did consultations, and we did specific things like the village of Uafato, which is about more than an hour's drive from Apia. It's a very remote village, and it's a beautiful village surrounded by mountains and waterfalls. And there was an old bird hide. It's a trail. It's about 800 metres, a steep trail. There was an old bird hide. So one of our first projects was to reconstruct the bird hide, and there's a beautiful new bird hide up there. And then we worked with the village to help to promote a little ecotourism venture for the village. So we did some training with tour guides. We actually pulled in tour guides from all the villages and did a training together. And then we had an opening of the bird hide. So it's all there ready for when the tourists come back. But it's a beautiful spot, and some tour guides have been trained there. So that was one of the things that we did in that particular village.
Okay, so is this right that you've got this term that you use, a manumea-friendly village, is that right?
Yes, that's correct. So we have at the moment 5 manomea-friendly villages. So Uafato that I mentioned is one of them. The other one is Falea Se'elau. And then we have Malulele, which is up on the hills in town. And there's an amazing reserve there. And the MNRE and Moi, who you'll speak to later in her role at the MNRE, they've done a lot of pest control up there and habitat restoration. We've also done habitat restoration and pest control in Falea Se'elau. And then in the island of Savai, where the bird's been seen most recently, and again, Moi will talk about that, in the villages of Opo and Salilolonga, we've also been working with those villages for a period of time. So SCS, Samoa Conservation Society, and MNRE, we have relationships with those villages, and the villages themselves, because in Samoa there's a governing system in the villages called the Council of Chiefs, and there are what we call matai, or chiefs, and they're often discussing conservation projects, what's happening, what's going to happen. So we also went out into the villages to talk about, as James mentioned, hunting. And, you know, we didn't go with the hard sell hunting bans, because we realised that people have to make a living. And also, as James mentioned, we try to give alternatives. So ecotourism is one. Other green livelihoods, for example, in our village, we've just put in a marine reserve, so there are crabs there that people can gather and sell, not in the reserve, but around the area. And then there's different fish, and just keeping everything clean, and people can have their livelihoods from the sea as well. So when we went into our village, they were already aware of hunting, and our village, Falea Se'elau, and also Uafato, actually already had hunting bans in place. So, you know, it's a lot of consultation and talking together with the people. And, you know, they've already made those laws for themselves. So we're kind of using those 2 villages as an example. And as we get more funding and as we work in more villages, we're looking at other people, you know, looking at the example of these villages that already have a ban. So in our village, if you shoot a lupe, which is the bird that's often mistaken for the manomea, and that's the one that people like to eat, you can get fined 500 or 1,000 tala, and that's how it's policed locally.
So, okay, so how do you keep on coming up with ideas and campaigns? Because it's really important to keep on telling the story, and you come up with some amazing initiatives. I mean, when we first got involved, Ralph and myself, in supporting your work, we got to listen to a song which was very, very familiar. Tell me a little bit about this song and what happened and who took part in it.
On the campaign, it's been really great to work with Flinch Marketing, and the director there, Steve Menzies, has been back and forth to Samoa before COVID. But because in New Zealand, we have a large Samoan population, a large Pacific Island population, and a lot of the people there have very strong ties back to Samoa. So Steve worked with a very popular comedian. His name is Tofinga Fepulia'i, and Tofinga's well known in New Zealand and Samoa. He comes here, and and he's a comedian. So he did a song for us. It's actually, the tune is the ABBA song, Mamma Mia, but the words were changed to Manu Mia. So Tofinga helped us out by doing an ad, and as he's very popular in New Zealand and also here, we were able to put that on social media. He's singing, he's dancing, and it also shows some of the campaign that we've been doing in Samoa as a video to go with that song. But it's fun and it's light. And then Tofinga also spoke about the hunting ban. We have a time of year in Samoa in October, White Sunday. It's a children's Sunday, and it's a traditional time when pigeon is eaten, and we were able to put that ad on TV. So it had Tofinga, who everybody knows, being funny, and then also with a serious talk. But you know, it's not all doom and gloom. Sort of, he was uplifting the villages that already have bans in place, the villages that are already working to save the national bird of Samoa, to save the Manu Mea. So that was great. And then we went out into the community, one of the villages of Falea Se'ela, and one of our young guys there, he took the tune and he made the song in Samoan. So we did an ad out there, and it was local guys. It was about going hunting. It gives them alternatives, and it's fun and it's funny, and the messages come from the people themselves. So that was a lot of fun to do. A lot of things on the campaign we did was fun. The murals were hard work, but they were fun. Charles and Janine actually painted another mural and did a workshop at the same time for local artists. We brought in some artists from our key villages, and we had some from our Ministry of Education, and then those artists have gone back to their villages, and we've painted, I think, another 5 murals. So we're getting them the message out around Upolua and Savai.
Okay, well, look, all I can say is it sounds like you've been having a lot of fun, but all I've got to say is, Manu Mea, here we go again. My, how can I resist her?
Exactly.
So, you know, I mean, and that's the thing, isn't it? You've got to try and make things fun, because we can all tell people they're all dreadful swine and they're destroying the planet, but that's when people switch off. So we have to get the messages out. We always say, Ralph and I always say, if you can make people smile, you've just got a chance of getting a serious message through as well. People smile, they become receptive. Tell them they're dreadful, they close up.
Absolutely, yes. And that's what we did with Tofinga. That's what our local ad is funny. If you understand Samoan, it's actually really funny. We put subtitles too. But I was out in the village the other day and the children were singing the song. And I said, where did you hear that? They said, oh, we heard it on TV. So, you know, as you say, the message is getting out there. And I'm really glad that we can have this podcast. And really, we would like to express our thanks to yourself and to Ralph. It's really interesting that we started off with this campaign, and then different ideas come from a team of people, and it's been amazing to have yourself and Ralph on board. And we've set up our website, www.savethemanumea.com, if I can put a little plug in for that. And we have your prints for sale, which is amazing, just so supportive and so exciting to have that, and not only to have support from New Zealand, but now to have support from the UK. So, you know, we would really like to thank you for that. And it's, like you say, they make people smile and the artwork's beautiful, and it's been great. We also have a dance group in Australia, and one of our former Miss Samoa, her name's Mary Jane McGibbon-Swinky, when she became Miss South Pacific 20 years ago, she wore a beautiful costume and she danced a Manu Mea dance. And I just saw a video a few days ago, and her daughter is now wearing her costume, and they're still doing the dance and they're still putting out the message. So it's exciting for us to know that there are people supporting us and that are getting the message out there. And with the artwork, with the murals, with the dance, with the songs, yeah, people in Samoa are coming on board. And, you know, things in the environment changes take a long time. Sometimes they take a whole generation. So I know from living in the village that our village has really become conservation focused, but it's from the children, from the youth. They're the ones that are going to make the difference. So if we can get the message across, you know, we're not going to stop pigeon hunting in a year, but we've started this campaign. And if we can continue it and get the message out to children, we also have a children's book set here in Samoa called Mossi and the Manu Mea, about a little boy and his cousin going out into the forest to search for the Manu Mea. Manomea, and we've had feedback. The children are saying, we want to go and find a Manomea, we want to go and find a Manomea. So, you know, having everybody on board, hopefully we're getting the message out there. And as you say, it's fun and, you know, it's for the future.
Exactly. And thank you very much for your kind words as well. Look, it's what you guys do that drew us in. We just happened to be shown it and you just go, yeah, in this world, we need to show more compassion to the world around us and we all need to stick up for the little guy. That's really all it's about. And just to say, there is absolutely no problem in bigging up the website or anything at all. You know, it is www.savethemanumea.com. And Manumea, M-A-N-U-M-E-A. And also, if people don't know, we managed to sort things out and Ralph did a print of the Manumea, which he drew, which is fantastic. It is only exclusively available on the website. You won't find it anywhere else. And all the money from that is going towards the campaign. So honestly, it's an unbelievable chance for people to go and get a Ralph Steadman print, which is signed. So go on the website and you will find it there available. And it can be yours for a very reasonable price. Right, that's the selling done.
Thank you.
Oh, pleasure. That's my job. I sell. But I would like to bring in the third member of this triumvirate tonight. I'd like to bring in Moy, because you've been sitting there patiently waiting for everyone to say their bit, and it's now your turn. How are you? Thank you for waiting such a while. It's good to speak to you.
Thank you so much, Gary, for having me on the program. It's a pleasure to be here and talk to you. I am doing very well, and I've been sitting, waiting, just be happy to come on board and share with you.
Excellent. Well, now that I wanted to talk to you because I'm curious as to how long you've been working with the Manumea, and isn't it the subject of academic work for you as well?
So I have been working for the Manumea since 2007, when I started working for the Ministry of Natural Resources and Environment, and continue on until today. So this year, I've been fortunate to receive an award, a Fulbright scholarship, doing a master's program at the University of Colorado State University. So we're currently working together with the Samo Conservation Society and also with the ministry with this project. So yes, I've been very lucky to have this opportunity.
Oh, fantastic. Well, congratulations. And it spreads the word of the Manumea far and wide. So, you know, it's wonderful to hear. So keep on going. That's what I'd say. Now, look, you go out and do a lot of field work, don't you? What does that entail? People always hear this word, field work. What does it actually mean? Or in this case, with the Manumea?
Yes, so when I started working with the ministry, part of my passion is to go out in the field, searching, looking for new things to discover. And what we did back then was we worked on a program to monitor lowland bird species at one of the offshore islands. So part of this program was to eradicate rats, having a great impact on the survival of the friendly ground dove on the Nutele Island. So that is when I started to pick up on this passion with going out into the field, looking at these birds, because I didn't know about these birds. I didn't know that we have so many species of birds out there, and not only birds, reptiles, insects. That is when I discovered that there's a lot out there that we need to look out for. And also that's when I found out as well that some of these species are actually threatened or vulnerable and at very risk of extinction, such as the toothpick pigeon or the Manumea. So when we do our planning or field surveys, I'm always happy to look up to and packing my things, you know, to start going out, because I guess that's when I feel more complete, more happy when I'm out in the forest. So, yes.
Okay, well, look, you are a very, very special person because you've seen a Manumea not just once, but twice, haven't you? One was some time ago And then you had a sighting last year.
Exactly. So we were fortunate to get an award under the Conservation Leadership Program. We were working with Dr. Rebecca Sternman, who's been doing a lot of bird work in Samoa as well. So we were part of the team with the ministry, and we had funding from the Conservation Leadership Program. So this took us for 1 year to search for the Manumea, and from 2013 to 2014. So at the end of 2013, in December, funny, this is what I always tell about this story, that we were spending months camping in the forest. We went to the big island of Savai, because in Samoa, in Upolu Island, we've been looking around and we've only heard, we assumed it was Manumea, but we couldn't be certain about it because we didn't see any. And that was the rule that we had when we did the survey, was if we hear something that we suspect is toothbill pigeon, but we don't see it, so we can't be 100% sure that that's the bird that we were looking for. So in Obolu, we did surveys and we heard calls, so we were suspecting that it's Manumea, but we couldn't be sure about it. So we went to Savai, the big island, and again, the same thing. We spent weeks camping, moving from forest to forest, working with communities, and then we still the same thing. We didn't see anything, but we heard the same call that we suspected it was of Manumea. And one rainy day, it was towards the end of the day, we were in the rain and in sun and in the rain. And then we came back to our accommodation because it was sunset. And then we were cleaning our things and tidying up everything ready for the next day of survey. And then one member of our team went to hang his clothes on a wire outside. And then I heard a loud flap on the tree. This tree was just right outside our accommodation. And then he looked up and saw a dark figure up on the about 10, 15 meters high from a tree that we called Moso'oi. And he came running inside the room and asked me, "Hey, I think that's the bird that I just saw." And then, "Okay, what does it looks like?" And he said, "It's big. It was making a loud noise when it landed, I think, but it was kind of dark. We couldn't really see the bird under the tree because it was shadowing." So we went outside. I hurried, opened up the laptop. I look at one of the photos from the Natural History Museum in New York. So Dr. Rebecca sent us a photo of the juvenile specimens that are in the museum to refer to. So these are some of the photos that we use to identify the bird if we see something. So I look at the photo, took the camera and ran outside, and Philele was already looking up the tree with his binocular. And if we see a bird, we are still unsure. There's one feature that we have to look for, and that is the beak, because this is the only big bird that has a hook-billed beak. So we couldn't find, we ran around outside the gate, and then that's when we were 100% sure of the bird that we were looking at, because then there was a sunbeam that shined on the bird and it showed clearly the colors of the juvenile Manumea. We took photos, tried to take as many as we could and sent back to the office and the experts to reconfirm to us. But at the time, we were 100% sure that we were seeing the toothbill pigeon right at the accommodation that we were living in. So it's kind of funny, long story, but it tells us something that we've been out there. We were looking at the bird. Wow, we've been spending all these days and months of camping and looking for the bird. Or maybe the bird actually sees that we're tired and we're doing what we can, but we still couldn't see it. So it came all the way down to find us. So those are some of the stories that we made up. But so that was in 2013. And then just last year, we did another community project at our Opo Savai. And we were doing field surveys up at the Central Upland Savai on Mount Silisili. So here around 1,650 meters elevation, again, we saw an adult. So this time it was an adult, and it was very bright because we saw it at around 1 p.m. to 3 p.m. That's when we did the survey, and we saw the bird again as it was landing on a Rhinoxia tree up on the Mataleafi, what we call Mataleafi. So that was the second sighting that we had of the Manumea. So I was very lucky to see it because in 2013 we saw a juvenile one. And then in 2020, again, our team was out there and I saw an adult bird. And I was so sure of the adult bird because it was so bright colors. The red color was so bright of the wings as it landed. And it was a very unique sighting because the bird landed on the trunk of this Rhinoxia tree. So it was very clear. We couldn't get the cameras. Our team tried their very best to make sure that we could get a camera, but we heard the bird lift, and so it was a bad luck that day that we weren't able to get a photo of it.
But it must be an amazing feeling. I know what it's like when I see a bird that I've not ever seen before, and when I've seen critically endangered species. There is something magical where time almost stops when you have time with this bird, but at the same time you're having these weird little moments where you're going, but I've got to just ID it correctly because I know it is, but I've got to check the bill or I've got to check this. So you're trying to keep all your emotions in check, I always find. Yes. I mean, how did it feel for you once you've realized it is exactly what you want it to be? Because that's the other thing. A lot of people turn birds into something else. The amount of times I've turned rubbish bags into some really rare vagrant that's appeared from nowhere is unbelievable. But once you realize it really is and you've managed to ID it, what's the feeling like for you? I mean, is it something that's almost indescribable?
Oh, yes. It's like the whole team, me and the whole team, we were winning a lotto. Over about a decade of, you know, we had experts from everywhere flown into Samoa to find and get a picture of the bird. But now we're not only seeing it, but we're actually photographing and the juvenile. And one thing about when we photograph that juvenile was that it tells us that the bird is still there, but it's also breeding successfully because that was a baby one. And we are still talking about, some of the experts thought that this is about 3 weeks post-fledged from the nest, but we are unsure. So experts are still working on getting the right information, but the feeling when we saw the bird, we were like over the moon. Okay, now we're certain it's still here, because when we went out doing the survey, everyone tells us, okay, you can go look for your bird, but it's not there. It's extinct. No one has seen it for a while. But we had this feeling that, no, we know it's out there. We will come back and give you the evidence that it's still out there. And when we got it, we were over the moon. So indescribable feeling that we had in the field. And we just couldn't wait to come back to the office and prove everyone wrong. So there you go, your evidence.
That's fantastic. And that is exactly why you are all doing this work, so that ultimately everybody can get a chance to see a population of the bird across the island and restore it back to health. We're just about out of time now. I would like to thank all three of you, James, Jane and Moy, so very much for taking time to come and talk to us. Your work is important. We support you. And I hope that this podcast will find more people to come and see the work that you're doing and help support you too. Thank you very much for being my guests tonight. This has been Gonservation Conversations. Gonservation Conversations is presented by me, Kerry Levy. Our series editor is Leon Rachinsky-Gorman. Our producer is Jackie Anklin. Our executive producers are Ralph Steadman and Sadie Williams. Our series consultant producer is Gary Hayes. Music by Leon Rachinsky-Gorman, lyrics by me. Find out more about Gonservation and Gonservation Conversations at gonservation.com and on Instagram and Twitter at Gonservation. Gonservation Conversations is produced as part of the Highway 61 network, supporting independent producers. For more information and podcasts like this one, visit highway61.media or highway61_podcasts on Instagram and Twitter.